When you think of the well-packaged trauma patient, what comes to mind?
Now you can be the doc in the bay with a new trauma patient.
Wow, there's blood everywhere. Just like the real thing.
The well-packaged trauma patient in stores now.
Gurney sold separately by Mattel.
Don't close your eyes because you might be driving, but just visualize.
What the hell are you doing?
Rob Borman said, close my eyes and visualize.
Can you please watch the road?
Okay.
Look out!
Okay. Did you get it out of your system?
IVs, maybe some O2. But surely, surely the rigid cervical collar. In preparation for this talk, I looked at a bunch of references, did some searching on my own, and all I could find was information on the non-utility of cervical collars. But when you see any trauma patient, any trauma scene, what's ubiquitous? It's the rigid cervical collar. When we were told that 50% of what we learned in medical school was wrong, utility of the cervical collar, I assure you, was not one of them that I thought would be proven wrong. And this must have started somewhere, the use of the cervical collar. So how did we get here? Surely there must have been some evidence, some spark of reason that set the cervical collar revolution in motion.
There has never been any evidence, any trials, even poor trials, that have suggested that the C collar benefits our patients in any way, shape, or form.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the voice of one Dr. Chris Caldwell, professor of emergency medicine, University of Colorado School of Medicine, emergency department chief, Denver Health Medical Center, and the Denver EMS director. The list of titles is long and distinguished. And if you were at ASEP 2014, you may have heard Chris's talk on spinal mobilization. And on that note, back to the meat and potatoes. Now, we use C collars because trauma patients may have an unstable C-spine injury, and if we move that injury, we could paralyze the patient. Case in point, inline stabilization during intubation. We make every effort not to extend the neck.
It's not motion that causes harm, but energy. And Hoswald, who has written a lot on this topic, really showed us this quite well in a couple of publications, one most recently in 2012, that really talked about energy being the area that we worry about. So this absolute terror of causing any mobility, I think, is not only unfounded, but it goes against reason also. And we've talked about those examples of people that have self-extricated and gotten up and walked around the scene with what turned out to be unstable fractures, and yet have always done just fine with that. We need to be focused on preventing energy. Basic motion, particularly motion that they are able to guide, has never been shown to cause any harm.
Okay, well, I'll take that the energy causes the harm. It causes the initial injury and not the motion. But once the harm is there and maybe there's an unstable cervical spine fracture, I mean, won't extreme movement or twisting of the neck, like when we're rolling a patient off a backboard, of course, based on our previous conversation, maybe won't be happening as much, but won't movement cause more harm?
There is no evidence that that is the case. Harm that has been done by the energy of the accident, whatever happened, has been done.
Does the collar prevent further damage to an injured C-spine? Bottom line is that there's no evidence of this. It's not about immobilization, but about the energy being translated to the spine. In fact, the way that collars are often poorly fitting, the way patients strain against them, can actually increase the energy that's being transmitted to the spine and lead to additional damage. Minimize movement? Sure, but do we need to immobilize to do that? No evidence of benefit and definitely a potential for harm.
Trauma patient comes in, they don't have a collar on. You're thinking, they could have a cervical injury. And you say, just put the collar on till we get things sorted out. I mean, what's the harm in that?
Think about that, what I would call somewhat barbaric practice of taking somebody who is perfectly fine. Maybe they hurt. Maybe they have been certainly involved in an accident that has risks for injury. Now we're going to take them out of the area of comfort that they're in, that they found for themselves, and we're going to put this rigid cervical collar on, which extends their neck, and put them in a position where I don't think anybody is going to argue they are now uncomfortable and suggest that they are safer in this situation. You also have evidence that putting C collars on reduces venous return, increases intracranial pressure. And there was an article that was published in the American Journal of Emergency Medicine this year. Josh Gaither was the primary author, that talked about failed airways and how access to the patient's airway, and in particular with when you are restricted by that hard cervical collar, was one of the primary reasons why we struggled with airways in the field. And so access to the neck for either airways or other things is yet another downside of that cervical collar. We have something that was never based on evidence, something that does cause harm, something that in many cases we feel almost barbaric by putting on patients just in the process that we do it. And yet this is something that we've allowed to become our standard. It is our culture, and we do it without ever really challenging that process. I wonder if we were to approach the FDA or any regulatory agency with a device or medication that has no basis to it, no data behind it, may cause harm, and see how quickly we might get that approved.
Wasn't there a study that looked at countries that don't use cervical collars and then countries that do use cervical collars? And I don't know if there was no difference, or maybe the countries that didn't use cervical collars had better neurologic outcomes. I'm just remembering something like this in the past.
There absolutely was. It was back in the late 90s, and it was Hoswald again that did this study where he compared immobilization practices in Malaysia, which didn't do any immobilization, to immobilization or patients in New Mexico, which did the same as all of us have done traditionally, is full immobilization. And they compared quite well. Obviously, it was not a randomized control trial, but they compared patient populations quite well and found that those that were immobilized did worse than those in Malaysia that were not immobilized with similar injuries.
I'm really comfortable with the concept you're talking about, but thinking about going into my next shift and I have a major trauma patient who's been in a massive motor vehicle accident and they've got facial trauma, head trauma, chest trauma, and the thought of taking off a cervical collar and letting their neck go off flippity-flappity is making me diaphoretic.
And I do understand that, and I realize culture is very hard to change, which is one of the reasons I believe we may need to be even a little stronger than that position statement that you referred to that so beautifully brought us into the, hopefully, the 21st century with regard to backboards. I think maybe even stronger language is going to be needed because we need to change that culture. But at the same time, I do recognize that if you're going to take the most extreme, wildly combative patient that has no way of trying to control their behavior, I understand that may not be where we're going to start the process if we're still in the practice of completely immobilizing these patients. Forcing immobilization on anyone, more so even a combative patient that's trying to fight you, could actually increase your risk and increase the energy that we are subjecting our patients to, and therefore the potential for damage.
Agitated trauma patient with potential for a C-spine injury, and I know what you're saying, that never happens, but let's just assume that maybe this could happen sometimes. The answer isn't going to be fighting the patient into the collar, as I've seen so many times done. Sedate the patient so they don't move around so much, which is going to be beneficial not only to the patient, but also to the team because it's going to facilitate the workup. If you have to intubate to make this happen, just do it. Now, what about the cooperative patient who can't be immediately cleared? It also doesn't make a lot of sense to force this patient into a collar either. Just tell them not to move around too much and to wait until they get that CT scan done.
Well, I'll tell you that the image that people can't get out of their head is that patient is lying, just, you know, sitting there chit-chatting with you, lying in the stretcher, sitting up at a 45-degree angle. They turn their head and they're a quad. That is the thought, or at least the barrier to changing the paradigm.
I've had that image presented to me many times, and I've tried to get that image out of my head. I understand that. I think those cases of patients that are able to cooperate, move with what they are comfortable with, they're not going from completely neurologically intact to now with neurologic deficits. Getting some of that dogma and that legend out of our thought process and moving forward and say, let's be rational about this. No evidence that they are benefiting in any way from putting them in that collar. The only argument you could make for a benefit, it reminds us as physicians, oh yeah, we haven't cleared that neck yet.
I asked you to send me a couple references because I thought this is going to be something that you got from the back of a cereal box. And
I did.
There's nothing to it. And then you sent me pages of stuff. You were talking about Hoswald before. And in 1998, academic emergency medicine, a higher chance of neurologic deficit if you're immobilized. What?
I know, it flies entirely in the face. And I remember, you know, even as early, and you were a resident back at Denver General with me in the 90s, where some of our medics would bring these patients in on scoops and take them off and not leave them on the backboard. And we would tell them how awful they were and they needed to be back in these spinal precautions. And I think about even back in 1998, we had pretty good evidence that suggests that the folks that weren't doing any of this were benefiting their patients more than we were.
All right, message received. In blunt trauma, C-collars have never been shown to be beneficial, and there's a potential for harm. It may increase the energy transmission to the spine. What about in penetrating trauma, though?
Penetrating trauma. Literature on this is shocking. Double the mortality when penetrating trauma is immobilized.
These patients do worse when we put them in immobilization. And so for penetrating trauma, I think the answer is fairly clear. It doesn't really matter what situation you're finding. If it's penetrating trauma, immobilization is not indicated.
Even shot to the head. There's articles specifically on this. Shot to the head. Don't immobilize.
Don't immobilize. And perish the thought, one of the things we could do to make them worse is to put them into immobilization procedures.
We're kind of gathering that all of this immobilization isn't necessary, but we have this tool that immobilizes, this rigid cervical collar, that when we take it out of the plastic bag, kind of put it together. Does that collar actually restrict neck movement?
We have absolutely no evidence that that C collar restricts movement in any way that could potentially be harmful.
Whoa. Let's go back a second here. Can you repeat that one more time?
We have absolutely no evidence that that C-collar restricts movement in any way that could potentially be harmful.
I'm not getting this. I'm going to need to hear that one more time.
We have absolutely no evidence that that C-collar restricts movement in any way that could potentially be harmful.
So let's review what we've got here at this point. There's no evidence that the collar helps in blunt trauma with a potential for harm. There's robust evidence that the collar worsens outcomes in patients with penetrating trauma who don't have a focal neurologic deficit, and the collar doesn't even restrict movement. That sound, ladies and gentlemen, was my mind being blown. Dr. Caldwell, mic drop. Walk off stage. Actually, Chris, I'm sorry. Could you come back up here? We're not done yet. We got a couple more questions to ask.
Okay, I'm going to run through a couple of cases here, things that we will probably all see in our next shift.
Case one.
Drunk guy found down, gets put in a cervical collar, and the idea is that it doesn't come off until he wakes up and can at least communicate. And then there's the repeated battles. He sits up in bed, the collar is askew. Sir, lay down and do not remove that collar. And then there's this dirty little secret that once they self-DC the collar, it rarely goes back on.
And we've seen that so many times from residency. And unfortunately, I'd like to say that never happens in our shop anymore, but it does. I would provide just as much evidence as we have that we're helping those patients, that we're actually harming them, because we have this idea that because we put them in the collar, they can then move around and do all that thrashing about and they're somehow safer. The answer for those patients is to sedate them. And maybe we're not as aggressive as we should be about sedating those patients to protect them. And we have good methods of doing that now that are very effective. We don't have to paralyze and intubate all of them. We can sedate them reasonably to the point where they're not thrashing about and they are much safer. The idea that they'd be in the collar and can thrash about and are okay might be not only fooling ourselves, but putting them at greater risk.
Let me ask you your practice, because I know this is something that is going to be seen in your shop today and was seen in your shop yesterday, found down, intoxicated, not violent, not belligerent, just really drunk, but you don't know what happened. Say they come in a collar. Do you leave them in the collar? Do you take them out of the collar?
I won't suggest that we are 100% exactly the same across our staff. I am far more aggressive, and I think there's a number of our staff that are far more aggressive than others about taking the collar off of those patients. Granted, it's not necessarily like the board, where if I see a board anywhere near a patient, I will get that out of the room. I'm not as quick to get the cervical collars off. And yet at the same time, once I've gotten a situation where I believe the patient is either cooperative enough to go by our direction and not move, or in the case you describe of clearly so intoxicated they're not going to be, that they're sedated either by their own doing or by our doing to the point where they're not going to move around, I am much more aggressive about taking that collar off, particularly in situations where it's their agitation point. And you've seen that as well. They'd be more than happy to just go to sleep. But that collar is what's keeping them up, getting them agitated, and causing them to move more than not having the collar would be. So I do need to take responsibility for keeping them in a safe environment. And obviously, if they fall off the cart or they get up and run into a wall and they do things that can create energy, then that's something I need to prevent.
This is a daily battle for many of us. intoxicated, arrives in a collar with unknown mechanism, and you and your staff are fighting to keep the patient in the collar. I mean, I'm not just talking about fighting, I am talking about hand-to-hand combat. You gotta put this guy in a full Nelson just to get the collar on. All that movement creates energy, and it's more likely to cause an injury to the spine than just leaving the patient without the collar. I find that either I have to sedate these patients to keep them in a collar, which isn't a great option because they've already got a sedative on board and now I run the risk of respiratory compromise. Or every 5 minutes, we're wrestling the patient again.
Where are you going?
Get your hands off him.
I said, where are you going?
Instead, I find a lot of these patients will simply lie still and fall asleep if that collar just comes off. This seems to me a better option in a lot of cases.
Case two.
80 years old, fall, head injury. They've got a goose egg and an 8-centimeter occipital scalp lack. No neck pain. Get me out of this collar. You know they've got a C1 fracture. Your index of suspicion is 118%. These patients often get put in a C collar. It is such a huge pain in the bottom. Buttocks, ass, rectum. Because, you know, they've got arthritis. It's uncomfortable. But they all get the C collar.
What a great example of a time where you're absolutely right. They all get in a C collar. And you're also right that that's a patient that's very high risk for high cervical injury. And these are the sometimes most concerning injuries that we are worried about and that we do all this for. And yet we perhaps are causing even more harm in that patient. There's a group out of Dallas. They put those patients with known high cervical fractures, unstable, that in the OR under fluoro and showed us how when we put them in our rigid cervical collars, how the spinal cord actually stretched and reduced the blood flow to that spinal cord. Putting them in a cervical collar may in fact cause harm, whereas I understand people are going to be hesitant and understandably so about going out and saying, we're never going to use the collar, we're never going to use any of these mobilization devices. I'm hoping that at least push the envelope enough to consider not using it.
Case three.
Patient in a motor vehicle accident, they walk into triage, they get brought back to the stretcher and they say, my neck is killing me. You know, actually, we're going to bump this up a notch. Boom, tingling in the arms. Slap that cervical collar on, get some images stat.
Let's really challenge the mantra here. This patient has already established through walking, through probably fairly significant movement in getting to the emergency department before you ever get a chance to see them, that they have tested any opportunity, even if you are worried about movement making this worse. He's proven to you that movement is not going to paralyze him. And I wonder how taking somebody who is comfortable and putting them in a less comfortable position is going to be of any benefit to them and is not, again, potentially causing them harm.
I think that if my neurosurgeon came down to the emergency department and saw that patient not in a collar, he would punch me in the face.
Orman!
Judy, can you grab two collars? Thank you.
And the trauma surgeons would be really close behind. And my point on that is I don't think we can do this in isolation, even if it's a thought exercise. I think that this is a conversation we have to have with the entire team. Because if you go into your next shift and say, throw all of these cervical collars out the window, we are wasting our time. That's not just getting a new type of suture. This is perhaps one of the biggest paradigm shifts in the history of modern emergency medicine. No cervical collar in trauma. It has to be a discussion with all of the players.
I couldn't agree more. This has to be a discussion with the entire team. But what better opportunity than now, if you haven't had it already, to have that discussion and to say, look at what we have here in terms of evidence for doing a real benefit to our patients, for reducing the harm that we are causing them.
And listeners, for a great online review of the myths of the cervical collar, check out ScanCrit, ScanCrit.org. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. And this is not the last we'll be hearing about cervical collars, I assure you.
Rob and Chris make an excellent point that you don't want to saunter into work and then start chucking all the C collars out in the ambulance like a baseball manager chucking equipment after he gets ejected. If you read the literature and agree with Chris, get your orthopods, neurosurgeons, and trauma surgeons together and discuss the literature, discuss changing your protocol, but don't go it alone, because in the rare case that something happens, you're exposing yourself to a world of medical legal pain, and you're going to find yourself in the next edition of Weinstock's Bounce Backs. This is really game-changing stuff. The transition away from routine immobilization with longboards and collars is an enormous culture change in emergency medicine and trauma. The bottom line is that collars don't keep the neck from moving, and even if they did, it's not about the movement. It's about the energy transmitted to the spine. Putting patients in collars can increase that energy delivery and be harmful. In blunt trauma, the evidence isn't robust that there's harm, but the evidence definitely is mounting. In penetrating trauma, the evidence is quite clear. Collars are harmful. Ready to change your practice? Sit down with all the players involved, trauma, ortho, neurosurgery, and your own colleagues and work through this literature and come up with a plan that all of you can be happy with. Is it possible that we're on the precipice of an era without collars? Oh yes, the day is coming.